The Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, November 20th. On our calendar today, we have six cases. Three are set for oral argument, only one for this morning, and then two for this afternoon. The first case on our calendar today is A-19-0667, State of Minnesota versus Heriberto Dominguez Bravo. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent and 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. When you approach the podium, you can move it up and down to suit, well, you know all this. And then why don't you go ahead and proceed whenever you're ready, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jill Brisboy. I represent Heriberto Dominguez Bravo, who was convicted of first-degree sale and possession of methamphetamine after a stipulated facts trial using procedures set forth by Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure 26.01, Subdivision 4. Appellant challenges the issuance of a search warrant for his apartment. When reviewing the issuance of a search warrant, this court gives great deference to the district court's decision and limits its review to whether the issuing judge had a substantial basis for concluding probable cause existed. However, in this case, the sole basis for the search warrant was an alert from a dog that was brought to my client's apartment and sniffed. And the issue in this case is whether or not that search was supported by reasonable articulable suspicion. This court reviews the district court's conclusion that this dog sniff or search was supported by reasonable articulable suspicion de novo. Today, I'm going to limit my arguments to whether Officer Lee had reasonable articulable suspicion to conduct a search outside of appellant's apartment door, unless the court has specific questions regarding probable cause for the search warrant. Looking at the totality of the circumstances in this case, Officer Lee did not have reasonable articulable suspicion to bring that dog to Mr. Bravo's apartment that day. The rational inferences that were drawn from the confidential informant's tips did not warrant this intrusion.
Was it a confidential informant or a confidential reliable informant?
Well, Officer Lee represented that it was a confidential reliable informant. It's appellant's position that it's the court to determine the reliability of that particular informant. However, I would agree, or appellant would agree, that that person was confidential and an informant. But it's the court that determines the reliability of an informant using the six-factor test. And that was the record that we sought to develop at the hearing before Judge Smith.
So, first of all, I want to back up. Really, there are only two issues that you're raising with respect to reasonable suspicion.
Correct.
Reasonable articulable suspicion. One, was the informant reliable based on those factors? And two, whether the police could corroborate the information, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And so why do you think that the informant was not reliable?
Well, I would acknowledge that the officer states that in the past, this informant had been used by himself and other officers and received information that had been led to arrests. However, it had to his knowledge, it had never led to convictions. And that is...
That cut.
Pardon?
He had a lot of contacts, but never led to a conviction.
Correct.
How does that cut? Is that cut in favor of reliability or against reliability?
I think it can be a neutral. It's going to have to look in favor of...
Kind of strange to have all those contacts and have no convictions.
I agree with that. But again, the officer testified, I believe, that he didn't necessarily always get follow-up, if I recall correctly, and I could be off on that. But again, the lack of convictions is an important factor. But again, I think that we also need to look at all of the factors surrounding this informant and not necessarily just that one particular piece. And I think it cuts both ways if I say that it's only important if there's convictions and that should be the sole factor. That's not my argument. My argument is we should
be... obviously, if there were convictions, the state would offer that as support of reliability. So shouldn't it cut the other way if you have all of these contacts and there are no convictions?
It should, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's a...
I disagree with you.
I have no doubt he will.
So what else do we know about this informant?
We know that he has provided information in the past. It's led to arrests. Officer Lee had worked with him for about 1 year, and other officers from the Minneapolis Police Department had worked from him.
He appears to be a regular informant.
Correct.
Which way does that cut?
I think it cuts both ways. Again, I would agree that officers have the ability to rely in part on an informant that has provided information in the past that they've been able to corroborate. But again, this is a person that has continuous contact with
the regular informant suggests that this is a person who is dealing in criminal activity on a regular basis?
Correct. And I was going to use the phrase criminal underbelly, and he's regularly has contact with individuals that are associated with criminal
activity.
The
fact that the officer had all of this contact but never had a controlled buy with him.
Correct.
How does that cut?
I think it cuts against the informant's credibility. Again, it shows that this informant isn't willing to put himself out there and verify what he's doing. He's simply getting in trouble. We don't know why he's there, and I think the court will probably come at me with that question, which is at the hearing, I sought to develop how did this information come to Officer Lee? Was it because he was in trouble and trying to work off a case? Was he a good Samaritan in this particular instance? We don't have that information, and again, that cuts against the respondent in this particular situation.
Well, does it cut against respondent because, I mean, can't we infer that they didn't want to reveal additional information in order for him to lose his position as an informant?
Correct. And that is,
But why would that cut against an informant? The fact that the police want to be able to use somebody on a regular basis who has been providing reliable information to them in the past.
And I appreciate that they can certainly do that, but again, when we end up in a situation where we're trying to determine, is this person reliable? Again, we don't know that information about why was this informant providing information in this particular instance.
Why does that really matter, though?
Why does it matter?
Yes.
Because, again, we have a situation where this informant provided a name, a generic name of Eric, a vehicle.
Why is Eric a generic name, or is that just the English name for Heriberto's name?
It could very well be, but again,
which is very common.
Correct. I agree that people have what we will say is American names when, you know, trying
English names.
English names, yeah. Correct. They will use those names, but again, Officer Lee, in his search warrant, stated he was never able to establish that alias Eric with Mr. Bravo. So again,
but didn't the informant identify him as Eric Bravo?
Well, and again, at the hearing, Officer Lee stated that he identified him as Eric Bravo. However, if you go back to the search warrant, Officer Lee intentionally uses quotation mark, Eric, end quotation, several times and does not use the name Eric Bravo. It wasn't until we were at the contested hearing that Officer Lee says the name Eric Bravo was used. However, in his application for the search warrant to the judge, he used only the name Eric and also talked about the fact that he was not able to connect the name Eric to Mr. Heriberto Dominguez Bravo.
The informant talked about observations of what he observed in the truck, right?
Correct.
Did he somehow connect that with his home?
He did not, and Officer Lee connected it to Mr. Bravo's home based upon his training and experience that people that have narcotics and or firearms in their vehicle likely also keep them in their home, and that was, I would assume, a rational inference that Mr. Lee or Officer Lee made based upon his training and experience, but that was the only connection to the home, which again goes back to my argument that there was no corroboration to this home.
Did the informant give any description of these drugs that he observed in the truck?
I believe it was methamphetamine. However, it was not a specific quantity that was described. Similarly, he was also describing firearms, but was not specific in the description of the firearms.
Was he descriptive about where it was in the truck?
No. It was a very generic.
Gathered, if this is the pickup, I gather it's not in the back end in the box somewhere.
Again, the search warrant is very vague on those particular issues.
So if it hasn't, not in the box, it's inside, the inference is that he somehow got to look inside the.
Correct. The inference is that he was in the vehicle at some point inside the vehicle. But again, there was no information that he had ever been, the informant had ever been inside the apartment and observed those items inside of the apartment from what we have in the search warrant.
Counsel, you know, looking at the two issues here that we've got in terms of whether the confidential informant was reliable and whether there's corroboration, we're just talking about reasonable, articulable suspicion. We're not talking about probable cause. And a lot of the cases you cite, quite frankly, go to probable cause, including the Ross factors, mm-hmm. which, well, let me ask you that. Can you cite any case law that states that the Ross factors, all of the Ross factors must be applied to a reasonable, articulable suspicion standard? Because everything I've seen, they apply only to probable cause. For reasonable, articulable suspicion, it seems to come down to these two factors of reliability and corroboration.
Sure. And no, I can't. I wish I could.
Okay.
But there's very few cases out there on that particular issue. The only case is the only case dealing with reasonable, articulable suspicion is the unpublished Weicker case. And again, that's slightly different because next to nothing was known about the informant. And again, I agree that reasonable, articulable suspicion is a much lower standard than probable cause, but it's still a standard.
So it seems to me that you're asking us to create some new law here.
I'm not asking.
I can't point us to any case. I mean, even Weicker, as you said, it was more like an anonymous tip, I think.
Correct.
So if you can't point us to any case and you're asking us to create, I see that as asking us to create new law, a new standard, and my question is, why?
I don't view it as asking you to create new law or new standard. I'm simply asking you to look at the facts in this case. We have an informant who is confidential, who has provided information in the past. The law enforcement...
And that information has been reliable.
Correct, yep.
So factor is met then.
Okay, and so he provides that information, and that's enough to go and conduct this additional search.
It's kind of in support of your argument. I think that alone, I don't think would be enough based on the case law. I think you need the corroboration as
well. That's correct. And the corroboration in this case is the fact that my client, Mr. Bravo, is associated with this Ford F-150 and lives at the Pine Tree Apartments. However,
the Ford 150 where the confidential informant saw a gun and drugs.
Says he saw a gun and drugs. But again, when the officer went to investigate this, his investigation revealed that he was able to confirm my client was associated with this vehicle. He lived at this place. He was unable to confirm the alias of Eric. One of the other pieces of information that this informant provided to Officer Lee was that my client was somehow associated with the Sinaloa cartel. He was unable to corroborate that. He didn't conduct a controlled buy.
So if I can ask you, I'm not a dog sniff expert, but would you agree that there certainly was reasonable suspicion, at least for Officer Lee to have the dog sniff of the vehicle that was identified that was clearly where the informant had seen the drugs and the gun?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's the difference between the vehicle and the residence.
Correct.
And to that end, there is actually more corroboration because the informant described Bravo to the officer.
Correct.
And so the officer was able to identify him through that description, and in turn, when the officer, through his own independent research, went to the informant and said, "Is this the person?" He said, and he was able to identify. So he was able to corroborate the information as to who Bravo was.
Correct. He brought a picture, and the informant said, "This is Eric."
Okay, so why isn't that enough then to meet the reasonable articulable suspicion standard?
But again, we don't have any independent corroboration from the investigation that Officer Lee conducted that there was criminal activity. He confirmed that my client was associated with this vehicle. He confirmed his identity.
Where drugs were seen.
Correct.
And so that's the criminal activity.
Correct. But again, we're talking about bringing the dog into a locked apartment building where my client lived versus...
Well, into the apartment? It was just a dog's...
Into the building where my client lived. And so it was outside of his door. But again, it was a locked apartment building. And that's the search that I am focusing on here.
Right.
There was never a search or a sniff outside of this vehicle. It was going into the apartment building. And the point that I'm trying to make is it's this added... So we have the confirmation of vehicle, identity, and residence. But again, any association with criminal activity was not observed by Officer Lee.
Right,
Officer Lee conducted a very limited investigation.
Right. But if you have a suspicion of somebody that's engaged in drug trafficking, which was part of it, that he was bringing that in from somewhere else, then the inference can be made, reasonable inference can be made, that that person will keep those drugs in the residence, and that seems to be the tie to the residence.
Again, I understand the tie to the residence, but there was no investigation up until that point. They didn't follow him. They didn't attempt to do a controlled buy, and my time is up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. To start off with, it is important here that we're not talking about probable cause. We're just talking about reasonable, articulable suspicion, the test for which is, quote, not high, unquote.
We're really concerned that this isn't some random or arbitrary kind of activity.
Precisely. It just can't be based on a whim or a hunch. And we had far more than a whim or hunch here. We had a CRI. And there's three things I want to say about the CRI and three key cases I want to cite.
Well, and before we, CRI, so he that's the label that the police put on him. For our purposes, he is just an informant or a confidential informant.
I think there's two different questions here. There's a question of whether he's a CRI, which just means he's been reliable in the past, and then there's a question of whether he's reliable in this case. But CRI generally refers to somebody you've used before, and now the question is it still reliable or reasonable to rely on that person in this case, and do you need more than that?
Right, but using the term CRI seems to implicate that he is actually or she is actually reliable.
I think it goes more to the past reliability, but I think ultimately it doesn't matter here because what we have here is, and this is one of my 3 points on the CRI, is an uncontroverted track record. The officer said that he had used the CRI for about a year, but before that the CRI had worked with other narcotics investigators for several years. This officer had used the CRI over 20 times. The CRI had never provided false information, and importantly, the information the CRI had provided had led to arrests, convictions, and recovery of several pounds of controlled substances and numerous guns. And I do want to point out that it's not true that this CRI's information had never led to convictions. What the officer said was there hadn't been any convictions yet on his cases, because he'd only been working with about a year. It takes a while for these things to work through. On page 21 of the transcripts and 22, he says there are cases that are still pending, but he goes on to say that there have been convictions based on other officers' use of the CRI. So this isn't a CRI who just said a bunch of things that were never corroborated. The CRI's information led to seizure of drugs and had led to convictions. So that's point number one, the track record. Point number two is the CRI had personal knowledge. He or she wasn't just relying on hearsay. He or she personally saw meth and firearms in appellant's vehicle. And then point number three is that the CRI not only identified a photograph of appellant, but also provided information on his residence and his vehicle. And that leads me to the first of the three cases I wanted to point this court to, which is Ward. It's cited on pages 5 of my brief and page 5 of my addendum. And Ward says that the corroboration of even minor details can lend credibility to the substance of a tip. So yes, the residence and the vehicle are not top secret information. But Ward says just corroborating those helps. Ward also says that an informant is presumably aware that he or she could be arrested for making a false report. So an informant has an incentive not to lie. That's case number one. Case number two is Timberlake, which is on page 5 of my brief. Timberlake says flat out, the reasonable suspicion standard can be met based on information provided by a reliable informant. There is no case that has ever said reasonable articulable suspicion requires more than just reliable information from an informant. And then the third case is Ross, which is also on that page, page 5 of my brief, which says that an informant who has given reliable information in the past is likely also currently reliable. And of course, there's other cases like Munson cited in Judge Smith's order that say the same thing. Track record is very important for looking at reliability, and there's no case that says track record isn't enough.
So are you saying that having a reliable informant is enough to meet the reasonable articulable suspicion standard, that you don't need corroboration?
I'm saying yes. That's what Timberlake stands for.
Corroboration is just an optional way of establishing reliability, isn't it?
That's true. And here you don't need to reach that perhaps tougher issue of whether just the word of the CRI alone would have been enough. Because, again, we have the corroboration. We have identifying the photograph, providing the information on the vehicle and the residence, and we have the important fact that not only is this not an informant, an anonymous informant, like in some of the cases that Appellant cites, but this is an informant with personal knowledge. And again, all we're talking about here is reasonable articulable suspicion. Clearly, that is more than a whim or a hunch. If we were talking about probable cause, we might have a more difficult argument here, but we're not. Reasonable articulable suspicion is a very low standard, as this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly recognized. Now, appellants argued today for the first time that a sniff of the vehicle would have been okay, but a sniff of the apartment wasn't. But appellant never argued below lack of nexus. So that argument's been waived, and appellants conceded that the officer made a rational inference that a drug dealer might have drugs or even the smell of drugs, trace amount of drugs, at his residence. And again, that's all we need for reasonable articulable suspicion. If they'd done a search of the apartment based just on this information, that would be a tougher issue. But we're talking about a dog sniff, which has been described as minimally intrusive. And in fact, it's less intrusive than a stop of the vehicle, which also could have been done based on reasonable articulable suspicion. We have this minimally intrusive dog sniff based on the track record, based on the personal knowledge, based on the corroboration. An appellant can't meet his burden of showing that Judge Smith clearly erred in finding reasonable articulable suspicion under the three key facts I've discussed and the three key cases I've discussed. And unless this court has additional questions, I simply ask that you affirm Judge Smith.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I just want to briefly come back and respond to counsel's arguments about the three cases that are important to respondent's argument. First, he cites to the Ward case where minor details are important or can lead to corroboration. The point that I was trying to make in my arguments is that the information that was corroborated in this case was biographical information, identity information, but the information related to any criminal activity was not corroborated.
Do you agree? Corroboration is simply another way of establishing reliability, isn't it?
Correct.
So there was no corroboration, and we had a good record as to why the informant was reliable, you wouldn't need any corroboration.
Correct.
So why do we fight? Are you saying that this record doesn't establish reliability of the informant without corroboration?
In this particular case, yes.
Why is that?
Because the only thing we know about this informant is that he was reliable in the past and that the information Officer Lee was able to corroborate was biographical information that could have been easily...
Corroboration for a minute. If an informant has been reliable in the past, isn't that sufficient in and of itself to establish reliability for purposes of reasonable articulable suspicion?
No.
Which case says that?
What the Ross factors talk about...
Does that?
No. But what the Ross factors talk about is this is the totality of the circumstances. We need to look at all of these factors And in this particular case, the court could look at the fact that, yes, this particular informant was reliable in the past, but he was unable to Officer Lee was unable to corroborate anything beyond easily identifiable information.
The case law is that an informant that is reliable, as established by prior activity, is sufficient for a reasonable, articulable suspicion, that you don't need corroboration. The only worry about corroboration is if you can't establish the reliability of an informant based upon his prior activity.
What Timberlake states is that the one factor alone may be important, but if you look at Timberlake, that was a first-time informant, not a person that was regularly involved in criminal activity or had some sort of knowledge of criminal activity. Those six factors, you can apply them how you want. But again, one alone doesn't necessarily establish that. Timberlake was different because, again, we were talking about a first-time known citizen versus a person who has, you know, provided information in the past. We don't know why they were there in that particular instance providing information. We don't have that information. And again, the fact that that Officer Lee was unable to confirm anything beyond Mr. Bravo's identity, his vehicle, his house, he didn't conduct a controlled buy, he didn't observe any suspicious activity. He simply took an informant who's given information in the past, confirmed that identity of the person, and conducted the search.
Information in the past which proved to be reliable.
Correct.
And from that we draw the inference that the information he gives us now is also reliable. Isn't that what this is all about?
That's the inference that Officer Lee drew. That's the inference.
That's not an impermissible inference, is it?
It is not. And I'm asking you to say that an investigator needs to do more than simply rely upon an informant. The informant then becomes the investigator in these particular situations. We can just get rid of the police officer, and the informant can come to the court and say, this person has drugs, I've seen them. But we need some sort of independent investigation to corroborate those things.
Counsel, I see your argument in terms of with Timberland, where that was I think that factually is different because that was a first-time citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first factor that we look at under the one of the factors that we look at. But do we need to meet all, I'm still struggling with whether we need to meet all six of the rosters.
No, and I'm not suggesting you need all six. You apply that combination however you feel fit. But again, I'm not suggesting all six have to be met. Again, it's a totality of the circumstances. One last thing I want to talk about Ross. In Ross, that particular informant gave Officer Weishar very specific information about where the person was going to be called and stated, wait a second, he has a different car. This is the time he's going to be. That's a much different situation than we're talking about here. We're talking about very vague and generic information. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. Very well done on both fronts. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time. That's our only case for this morning, so the court is now in recess.
So any more court today?
Yeah.
Really? Where are you off to now?
West St. Paul on a very serious hit and run case.
Oh, really?
You know, it's just so funny how your days go where you're like here, and then I kid you not, I'm going to like, have you been to the West St. Paul courthouse?
No.